Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
The real hard work is whipping votes to build political power alongside the sort of legislative and policy analysis that makes lawmakers comfortable enough to ignore the chambers of commerce, to ignore the California Bankers Association when they try to raise all these specters of evil when it comes to the potential risks of a public bank. The fact that they have so many black marks on their record, it's easy for us to point to those, but the real work is in positive, constructive organizing that builds undeniable political power alongside competent policy and reform.
That's our guest, David Jetty, talking about one aspect of the real politic of moving public banking into the world of public policy. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. We've been focusing on the dramatically expanding and evolving developments nationwide about creation of public banks. State and municipal legislators have been digging deeper into what these banks are and how they can become effective components of public administration. California, the fifth largest economy in the world, now leads the pack nationally, followed closely by the state of Washington and some other states putting their programs together in determining how to integrate these banks into policy objectives and organizational applications. Ellen and I will be talking about that in a few minutes. These challenges illustrate the key role that citizens must play in the process of introducing a new public institution. Public banks have a mission of service, but service to what, and for whom, and through whom? These banks have enormous potential to expand local and state government credit resources, but where will the capital come from, and how will it be managed? What sort of existing legal blockages might there be? And what sort of obstructions are being put forward by existing institutional stakeholders? These are examples of the public banking frontier that illustrate the dynamic and even esoteric considerations that face citizen proponents and legislators alike as they discuss the devils in the details of making public sausage, or policy, I mean. It's hands-on democracy, where everyone gets their hands dirty, figuring out how things should work. Well, later on in the program, we'll have a financial wisdom seance with a wise man, or perhaps I should say a wise guy, wise in either case, who's also from California, who will reflect on money, banking, and our engagement with both. Swami Biyandananda will share some stunningly obvious truths that will both enlighten you and make you laugh.
The banking industry has learned to use its energy, what the Chinese call qi, to gain unfair advantage. This is called cheating.
We'll connect with the Swami later in the program. But let's get into this week's discussion with Ellen by taking a look at how the popular upwising, as the Swami would say, which is underway in California and shining a light on the path forward and doing some important development work for the rest of the nation, which is following their lead.
We have more news this week on the development of public banks around the country, and it's all on the West Coast. What's happening?
Well, in our last program, we talked about California Senate Bill 528, which is a bill to turn the California Infrastructure and Development Bank into a depository bank, a true bank that would be dealing with municipalities as their clients, doing the same thing the development bank does now, but because it would be a depository bank, it would have a much broader reach. It would have more liquidity and more, you know, more ability to leverage its funds, and it would be duplicating the current model, but on a much bigger level. Well, another bill Assembly Bill 857 was put together by the California Public Banking Alliance, which is an alliance of, I think, 8 municipalities in California that are attempting to get a special charter that would more easily enable cities to set up their own publicly owned banks of the sort that is one of their prime movers. And LA, of course, had a bill for a city-owned bank that came close to passing, got 44% of the vote. So that's the idea. That's the model they're looking for. And one reason, of course, that bill didn't pass was that there are so many hoops that you have to jump through to charter a bank. And critics said, you know, it just couldn't be done. So we need to get rid of some of those hoops. And that's what their bill is about. So both bills have now passed 2 committees. The Assembly bill passed 2 committees in the Assembly, obviously. And the Senate bill has passed 2 bills in the Senate. And they'll be moving on. The Assembly bill has another Assembly committee to go, and then it'll go to the full Assembly and then to the Senate, and then the Senate bill will move along as well. So that's very exciting that they both have passed 2 committees. They still have a ways to go, and we know that things can go wrong, but often we see these bills that get introduced and then we get all excited and then we say, oh, this state has this bill and it looks really good, and then we don't hear any more about it. Somehow it dies in committee. But these are actually moving forward in committee, and I think one big reason is that they've got this huge push from the young people, and that, you know, there's just this huge popular push for AB 857, and that's why that one's moving forward. But also, there is the political will. You can just see that the legislators are trying. They see the problems, but instead of saying, well, it just can't be done, this is going to be too expensive or too many hoops, they're saying, well, maybe you can modify the bill to do this or that. You know, they're really trying to be helpful and to work with the idea. And I think one reason is that the governor is in favor of a publicly owned bank. And the previous treasurer worked for a year and a half trying to come up with a model for a cannabis bank. And the current treasurer, Fiona Ma, endorses a public bank. So they've got people at the top who are into it. Also, California has some serious funding issues right now, particularly with the fires, the Paradise Fire and the others. And PG&E is bankrupt. PG&E is being blamed for the fires, and of course then there'll be all these insurance claims. So the problem is the state should take them over and pay the claims, but then that means the taxpayers have to foot the bill. Or if the state just lets PG&E go out of business, then all these poor homeowners are going to be out in the cold. So it's a rock and a hard place. They definitely need another source of funding, and we think that a public bank could do it. So they're willing to explore.
Let's take a look at how a public bank, say the California iBank, was in place as a depository. How could it make an impact on the Paradise Fire and all that devastation?
Well, right now, when we fund any kind of infrastructure, we do it through bonds. And so I think the current rate is 4%, and it'll go up to everything's going up, so it's probably going to go up to 5%. The California Infrastructure and Development Bank does it for 3%. So if you just magnify that model, if you can, but it's very limited. You know, it's only got $300 million to lend. Yeah. But if you use that $300 million as capital, you could lend $3 billion, and that's just the start. I mean, the idea would be to grow and grow and grow after that.
Right.
Yes. So if you save, I mean, 1% may not sound like much, but those bonds go for 30 or 40 years. So if you project that over 30 or 40 years, you're talking about 25% of the cost of infrastructure.
Yeah.
So that's a significant savings. I mean, it would be great if we had a central bank, a California central bank, that could just issue the money. And actually, I've heard discussions of that we could have some sort of an alternative currency that was a California currency. You know, they do it in Uruguay or somewhere.
Yeah.
They do it in Latin America. You know, there are possibilities that could be explored, but we do need some extra money, and that would definitely help. And then if you put that together with the municipalities having their own banks, they could be doing the same thing. I mean, L.A. is a city that's many times bigger than North Dakota. It could, in theory, have a giant bank all by itself. And if you can merge all that liquidity from the whole state, there's, as Bob Hasegawa said, who's a senator in Washington State and heading the push for a state-owned bank there, he said, we've got money tucked in the, I think he said, in the couch cushions all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, there's bits of money that's just sitting there. That's not doing anything. It's all sort of rainy day stuff, or you're not allowed to touch it under existing rules. It's so circumscribed, or what a bank could do, a public bank could do, is so circumscribed, you know, with all the requirements for collateralization. And so forth. But if you did what Wall Street does, if you use their tools, which, I mean, they did go over the edge, but we're talking about keeping an eye on this system and really doing it in a proper, accountable way, you can expand the system a lot. And I think the prime model right now would be China, where 80% of the banks are government-owned, and they do a form of quantitative easing, or they do economic stimulus, but instead of using it to prop up the banks, like with our QE, they use their banks to create lots and lots of credit that goes right into the local economy and goes to support their workers with education and transportation and loans for their small businesses and medical care, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. The famed economist Bernard Leitar, who is actually, I guess, a central banker, helped to design the euro, made the point that the real purpose of the way things are ordered now is to perpetuate the same control over monetary issuance of credit, and that there's no interest on the part of the people who are holding the monetary power to begin to share it in a way that makes sense for the rest of us. They're perpetuating the status quo, so that the pursuit of public banks then becomes a real breakthrough opportunity for the people, that their systems can support what they really need. And I guess my only point here is that all of the stuff that we're discovering in the legislatures leads us to a new understanding of what we have to do to make these banks work. There's no reason why these banks can't work. If a bank can work for a private company, they can work for a public body as well. And it's certainly been demonstrated around the world. So it's
banks do have a magic money tree. I mean, they actually are where our money comes from, but they're not using it for public purposes, and that's what a public bank would do. And that's one of the major goals of the California Public Banking Alliance, is to get proper governance standards in there to make sure that these banks are subject to the will of the people, fully accountable and fully transparent, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Very important. We should mention, I think that Bernard Leitar, unfortunately, has passed away recently, and he was really a fighter for, he wrote a brilliant piece about what was really going on here, was that the problem was that banks create the principal, but they don't create the interest. And so we're all fighting each other for this interest that isn't out there. So you have to have more and more debt, which perpetuates this system. Debt, of course, is the business of bankers, and so they like it that way. We're perpetuating their big business, and they're not going to let us out of that.
Well, Ellen, I know you're talking to David Jetty today on the show, and David's been in the center of this California emergence. Looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
Okay.
So, thank you.
Thank you. I'm speaking with David Jetty, Legislative Director of Public Bank LA and a spokesperson for the California Public Banking Alliance. Great to talk to you, David.
Always great to talk to you, Ellen.
Thanks. So you were in Sacramento on Wednesday with your second exciting win of the week for California Assembly Bill 857. So I'm eager to hear all about how it went. But first, can you tell us something about the bill, what's in it, and what it aims to achieve?
Yeah, thanks. We were up there on Wednesday pushing for this bill. It is a pretty simple bill.
proposed by David Chu of San Francisco and Miguel Santiago here from LA, you know, at our urging, us being the California Public Banking Alliance. It's pretty simple. It opens the door for cities and counties to explore their own public banks. It clarifies the definition of a public bank. It establishes public banks as valid recipients of public credit and public investment. And it sets some guidelines for the application process and regulation of the banks. The bill has gone now through the Banking and Finance and Local Government Committees. It's taken on a couple of amendments, which our alliance was in support of, both amendments. And now we're going to face the Appropriations Committee to see how the government looks at how this will have fiscal impact on state revenues and state outlays. And then if we can get through that, we'll go to a floor vote in the Assembly. And then we have to do the other side of the legislature. So it's a long process, but these committees are important because they're the most sort of informed parts of the legislature. These are folks who have pretty narrow mandates, and there's fewer votes to get, but fewer chances to get them, right? You need 5 votes to get out of local committee, which has 8 members. It's a pretty focusing experience to have to convince a handful of people that the work you've been doing for a year is valid. And they have their own reasons for saying yes and no, but we were lucky, and we were lucky to have good authors and open-minded committees. So we look forward to the next piece, and, you know, as far as our role as an alliance is concerned, we look forward to keeping this bill broad in terms of the geographic locations it can cover and serve. To keep it secure so that, you know, there's no wiggle room for private involvement or meddling or watering this down so that it doesn't really get us to public banks in any realistic way. Mm-hmm. And we're keeping an eye on it to make sure it serves the people and is answerable to the people and not, you know, siphoned to a handful of even elected officials who may not be answerable to folks in frontline communities for climate change and economic inequality.
Right. I was up there a couple of weeks ago. I was called up at the last minute for an Senate Bill 528, which was to turn the California Infrastructure Bank into a depository bank. So it was really quite interesting watching that whole process and really how busy those committee members are, and they get these like one-inch bills the day before, and they're supposed to vote on them. So it really makes a difference, you know, what kind of arguments you make. So you must have done
it's
a great
true.
Job. Yeah,
yeah, it's true. They have so much to do. Yeah, 528 moved forward when I was there yesterday, which was Wednesday. So congratulations. I mean, congratulations to all of us, though, because it's good if public banking moves forward in any form. And as we know, you know, it's going to take a network of different models, a healthy economy, so to speak, but in the public sector where we iron out the real future for this sort of vertical for the finance industry. It's not going to be one case that rules them all. It's going to be a whole lot of different attempts. It's going to be starts and stops. There will be failures. There already have been, but it all builds on top of it, right? Everything we're doing right now is because folks like you and Public Banking Institute and people in Santa Fe and going back all the way to 1919 in North Dakota, like it's all a part of it. So, you know, there's no progress here without lots of successes and failures along the way.
Right. I totally agree. And I think what we need is a groundswell of support from also, not just for public banking, but I mean in general. Everybody knows that the current system is disadvantaging the poor and the middle class, and, you know, that the upper class has the upper hand. And one reason I can see is that if you can afford lobbyists, you definitely have an edge on legislation. So if you can get, for us, like for ordinary middle class or lower class type people, to just go up there and argue. I mean, we've been arguing these bills for whatever, 10 years now, close to 10 years. And we think we've made a good case, and then for some reason it dies in committee and nobody knows why. But that's the thing, if you, yeah. So it takes money to pass those things. But if we've got the numbers, the politicians pay attention to votes, and they're definitely paying attention to your generation that, you know, is making big waves and is demanding change. So even if, like, our original proposals don't fly, even if they modify them or something, they're getting the picture that something's got to give here, something's got to change. When I first got into it, I was sort of battling the other money reformers, you know, like nobody really even agreed on what we wanted to do. But now everybody knows that we want to fix the banking system, that the current system is not right, that Wall Street is not trustworthy. And anyway, so I think it's just a time in history.
Right. Well, and from a political perspective, I think that decision or policymakers, like folks on this committee and like the folks who are going to hopefully vote it in on the floor, like city leaders that we talk to in our divestment movements, they, at least in California, right, where we have a pretty democratic majority, and I live in L.A., a pretty metropolitan city, we're lucky that most folks have what you would consider a left-center-left point of view in terms of climate change and economic growth, you know, wanting it to be from the bottom and not trickle down from the top. And everybody, regardless of their associations politically, probably dislike Wall Street, unless you work on Wall Street or at CNBC. So there's plenty of ways in terms of opening the conversation from a personal level. It's why I think we have nowhere to go but up, because everyone that encounters this issue sees it as a common sense reform, something that feels missing. Once you're told about it, it's like, well, why doesn't this exist? So it's not hard to get the individuals to be on board. The more challenging part is confronting and compromising with the levers of financial control in these governments. And I don't mean Wells Fargo. What I mean is the fiduciaries in these governments who have to make these investments into private banks, into a potential public bank, these same fiduciaries who control the deposits that would be placed in these banks. A lot of them are on the hook from a legal perspective to make sound and prudent investments. And unfortunately, the definition of that is exclusive of social good and is completely focused on pretty narrow definitions of liquidity and risk and returns. So unless you can change those definitions or get those people on board with the idea that a prudent investment includes public and social good, public and local control, then they will be required to oppose you. And I've spoken with treasurers and with local banking executives who have said, listen, man, I agree with you, but from my job is to tell you this is bad because it's bad for the people I represent. It's bad for my shareholders, or it's bad from the perspective of a city that's trying to keep everything more or less the same, not take any undue risks. Now, you and I know that a well-capitalized and well-insured bank, public bank, is safer than a private bank. But for people who haven't seen a public bank with their own eyes or in their communities, they have to imagine it. And it's hard for people to imagine banks. It's our jobs, right, to help them and to make that idea possible. And when we bring these bills in front of lawmakers, our job is to lower the barrier of risk and let them know there are smart people working on this. There have been smart people working in public banks for a century or longer, and there's no reason California or wherever you're from couldn't do the same.
Now, that does require, like you said, some resources. You can pay a lobbyist. We're very fortunate that we have folks like Trinity Tran and Susan Harmon in our movement who more or less add up to a professional lobbyist or better. They have high credibility, high dedication. Well, I swoop in to do interviews and things like that, but the real hard work is whipping votes, not only in legislature, but on Facebook and in person to build political power alongside the sort of legislative and policy analysis that makes lawmakers comfortable, comfortable enough to ignore the Chambers of Commerce, to ignore the California Bankers Association when they try to raise all these specters of evil when it comes to the potential risks of a public bank and try to smokescreen all of their own obvious failures. And, you know, the fact that they have so many black marks on their record, it's easy for us to point to those. But the real work is in positive, constructive organizing that builds undeniable political power alongside competent policy and reform.
Right. And I think from the point of view of the bureaucrats, it's a lot safer to just keep things as they are. I mean, change in itself is risky because they're putting their reputations on the line. But what people aren't realizing, or I think one reason we're making as much progress as we are right now, is California particularly is in serious financial straits. I heard the governor saying how difficult it was being governor right now, and he's got the problem of Pacific Gas and Electric, for example. If you put it into bankruptcy, that we could take it over as a state-owned institution, but then we'd have the liabilities of all those fires, or it could just go into bankruptcy, which means all the people who were hurt by the fires are going to just have to bear, you know, there's not going to be any insurance for them. So we definitely need another funding source, and everybody knows that. So I think there's more political will right now than there has been, anyway.
I think in that case, I mean, it's, I don't know, if you asked me if a fire burned down my house because of a power monopoly, I would expect that power monopoly to pay for the damage to my home and my life. And if we've constructed our laws in such a way that those companies can avoid responsibility through things like bankruptcy, you know, the shareholders can walk off with the dividends they've cashed in previous years and c'est la vie, I don't really think that's fair. I don't think it's fair that the California taxpayer pay for it either, but the California taxpayer can borrow money at a pretty low rate, and it's in our interest to mitigate and compensate the victims of climate change and of the greed of our fossil fuel-powered economy. And if this is going to become a regular occurrence, then we're going to need short- and long-term disaster relief in the form of borrowing. And we have two choices. We can either sell that debt to risk-averse investors who want a tax-shielded investment, who can just make money on this need indefinitely into the future, or we can issue the credit ourselves, and any interest that comes from that can be rolled back over into public capital and buoy the investments that we need to make to prevent it from happening again.
Right. What people are not seeing, or the bureaucrats that are responsible for, or legislators that are responsible for making those decisions, it seems to me what they're not taking into account is the big picture of the whole state is at risk. The individuals in the state are at risk, at the risk of higher taxes, because there's nowhere else to find the money. If we have another source of money created by banks themselves in the form of credit, then we can obviate the burden on the taxpayers. Anyway, it just takes the long view, and we've got to just keep hammering away at these ideas. But I'd be interested in hearing specifically what the opposition said and how you know what your response was, just for other people that are, you know, up against similar fights in other states.
Well, just like victories are accretive to our cause, losses are as well. So current sort of line against us is, look at all these feasibility studies that have come to the conclusion that these banks are going to be risky, they face legal hurdles, they face scaling hurdles, and long times to until profitability, with so-called unknown risk and unknown consequences for municipalities or states. People frequently cite that Boston Fed report about a Massachusetts state bank, Santa Fe, Washington, and a number of the California reports. And then obviously, you know, we fought pretty hard for Measure B, but we did lose by 12 points. CBA representative was a little jealous on that. He said that we lost by 16 points, but that was not true. but, you know, the voters did reject that measure in part because it was premature and didn't have enough detail. And that's not a no forever, right? That is a comeback when you have more, because we spent almost nothing and we got 250,000 votes. So that's a lot of yeses as well. But the banking industry has the advantage of staffing most of the consultant companies that write these reports, and they have the status quo on their side. So they will continue to argue that the current status quo does not support or have very many public banks, and use that as evidence that they should not exist. But it's always a good time to remind them of the downsides of the current status quo, because they don't really have a lot of answers for why J.P. Morgan Chase needed to have San Jose's waive prevention policy waived in order for them to provide banking services to the city, because they've admitted at least 20 wage and hour violations in the state. Wells Fargo defrauded its own customers en masse. There were dozens of people in the state house on Wednesday who had been cheated out of their homes through improper foreclosures at Wells Fargo. These are the people that are coming in claiming that without public deposits, they won't be able to invest in their communities. And why would their employees volunteer hundreds of hours? Why would they make $200,000 donations to the local Boys and Girls Club if the city were to start a public bank and insult them so? It's not a credible argument, but it is powerful among the handful of people who decide what is prudent and wise about money. And we just need to wake up people that they are just as good stewards of their money as the princes of finance, that they can understand this stuff, and that once given the power, they will do things very differently.
Mm-hmm. And I do think if we just keep pushing, well, it's like in Washington State, they're on their fifth bill, and they are making progress just like we are. But every time they get rejected, like you say, like they lose one, they don't just go away and say, oh, we lost. They say, okay, you need us to respond to this, and then they change the bill so that it responds to whatever that particular objection was. In other words, it's kind of like the we just keep pushing the, you know, the tortoise.
It's an iterative process because you need to, you need to match the measure to the polity in a lot of ways. Which is, I'd love to dictate exactly what kind of bank is founded in which kind of city. They're public banks for a reason. The people have to agree, and the people have established governments, and we have to work with them if we want them to be legal. Of course we do. So we have no choice but to respond to publicly elected officials and try to answer their questions and concerns about individual bills. So AB 857 originally required all of these banks to obtain appropriate deposit insurance and had a choice between FDIC insurance, state private deposit insurance, which is used by some credit unions as an alternative to FDIC, and self-insurance by the entity that founds the bank. And that this would be a choice that the bank could have and have would have to be approved by regulators as well. So, you know, a municipality that did not have credit trustworthiness probably wouldn't be able to self-insure its deposits. But, you know, as you and I know, there's no need to have deposit insurance on public deposits held by a public bank insofar as the bank can pay back those deposits if they are demanded, and who would make a run on their own bank, right? But these folks understand banking from a current private context where if you're putting public dollars into a bank's hands, they need to be collateralized and insured. And so when we went to banking and finance and they saw this word self-insurance, the bill was not going to proceed. It was going to die. And when you have a choice like that, either you fall on your sword for a particular clause, or you move the bill along and possibly have public banks in a short period of time, but not with the ideal freedom that you want, you have to assess where you think you can end up. If you think there's no chance you're going to get to that end anyways, sure, you stick to your guns and you try to get the bill through that you need. But if you can get to that point and then fight from there, if we can get banks established and then get folks to understand that they're different from private banks and they might, you know, they should probably have different rules, and we can amend that structure over time, that's a more likely and realistic approach that deals with the current legislative circumstances. So we accepted that amendment, and now all public banks under this charter will be required to carry FDIC insurance. That's going to put them under federal purview because the FDIC is a federal regulator, but it makes the local lawmakers a lot happier, and it makes them a lot more likely to pass it through. So it's going to limit the kind of banks that we can start, but it opens the door to public banks. That's the constant
pull. Yeah, I don't think FDIC insurance is even a big issue because it's only required for $250,000. So it's not actually going to cost the city very much to get FDIC insurance. To me, the bigger issue is collateralization. Like, do you really have to post 110% of every deposit?
Unfortunately, collateralization, it's a third rail here, right, because of the Orange County bankruptcy in 1994. Collateralization is off the table, and we were more or less told that our bill would be laughed out if we tried to go after that. Now, the interesting thing is that the Bankers Association, specifically community banks, were very interested. When we were originally talking about relaxing collateral requirements for public banks, they really liked that because they thought it would lead to a relaxation of collateral requirements for all banks, right? That they could start to bring that number down. No bank wants to have to collateralize public deposits at these rates, but they're required to by state law, and treasurers have criminal liability if they don't observe that. So there was no changing that without changing the wider banking law. And one of the concepts we came in with originally was we need to try and make as little of a splash as possible with this bill and really make the splash happen at the local levels. Once the cities are enabled to do this, that's where activists can get really loud and demand exactly the bank that they want, because that's where that plan will be drawn up. But if we try to fight and destroy these sort of tenuous cords between government and banks at the state level, we're going to face considerably more resistance at the beginning of our movement. And it's, would likely push us out of the running. So yes, collateralization makes it so that these banks are going to have very limited lending power if their primary depositors are public entities. They're not going to be able to actually lend anything off that liquidity. They're going to have to take alternate deposits that don't need to be collateralized. But that's part of the evolution that we are likely to see, that these banks will treat public deposits as largely unlendable, that they will go out and find interest-bearing collateral wherever they can and bank that difference. That will accomplish the goal of divesting from private banks, but it will take some time before you can unlock the real power of the reinvestment capacity of those banks until you can relax those requirements.
Yeah, well, one way to get around it is with a letter of credit from the Federal Home Loan Banks, so that you just have to pay a little percentage. I mean, it's sort of like a guarantee on your deposits. And
yes, but it's also you have to reserve in certain balances. So we're not going to be able to just sign away the need to collateralize the deposits. They will need to be held in certain kinds of assets, in over-collateralized largely.
Yeah. I wonder why any bank even wants public deposits because of that requirement. But here's what I suspect, although I haven't been able to prove it. The big banks will take, like Wells Fargo, will take the deposits because they use them to buy federal securities, which are considered, safe. They're allowed to do that. That's what they collateralize with federal securities. And then they use the federal securities off the books as collateral in the repo market. So they borrow overnight against those securities. So they basically turn that money liquid while it's still just sitting there as bonds. So it serves them. The big banks can do it.
They're not going to have the scale or the international capacity to be able to do that. They're not going to necessarily have an investment banking arm that allows them to participate in things like that. And of course, public deposits and those federal securities can buoy the larger end of the balance sheets of these banks. But I think that the fact that governments rely on banks to manage their cash has its own inherent good, because it creates an interface between finance and government where government is entirely dependent on finance. And beyond the need to borrow from these banks, which they continue to have, the fact that they can't even access taxpayer money without paying a fee allows these financial institutions deep integration with the parts of our society that are most consequential for everyday people. So if the banks can manage the cash accounts of government, then they have one end in an end-to-end system where they can seize assets based on, say, criminal activity or delinquent taxes, where there might be interface between someone's citizenship and their homeownership. Basically, the exchequer of the treasury tells the sheriff where to go. And we've outsourced that job and let them keep the power of government. I don't know why banks would fight so hard to keep city deposits. I do think that municipalities are problem customers in a lot of ways, but I think it's because of this. I think it's this dynamic where they are the only folks who can really provide these services en masse. The laws are written that local banks are not even allowed to really handle city business. They're too small, and cities have to diversify. So these multinational banks can create schemes that satisfy these laws while not satisfying the spirit of the law. They can adhere to the letter by having all of these various buckets for public entities to put their money in with different levels of collateral and risk assessment. But above that whole layer of regulation is the investment bank and the large capital flows of international finance, which are far more sophisticated than banking regulators in the United States really deal with, and it allows them to get around a lot of those requirements in terms of actually keeping that money out of the economy.
Right. That one objection, or a major objection, to SB 528 was that the state's monies are in something like 140 local banks. But those monies are, that's a totally different thing. It's not their deposits, their liquid deposits. The liquid deposits are all in big Wall Street banks. Like you say, they're the only ones that are able to handle those deposits. So it's the big banks that control the Bankers Association that write these things and pretend that it's the little banks that are being disadvantaged, but they really aren't. It's the big banks that want those deposits, I think, for reasons that are not obvious. I mean, there are things going on off the books that we don't see, ways that they are using that money that we don't see. But what we're not realizing, like we worry about this little risk or that little risk. It's kind of like I live in a senior village and everybody's worried that the limbs from the trees might fall on them. So every limb that goes over any sidewalk has to come down. But you're not looking at the big picture. The trees are what give us, you know, oxygen and shade and beauty, and they raise our property values and all that stuff. So we, the state, have a huge amount of, and cities have a huge amount of financial potential, leverage potential that we're not using. We're giving that away to Wall Street, all because they have convinced us that we have to worry about all these small things. I mean, even if a city went bankrupt, like Orange County, they don't go away. It's not like a business that goes bankrupt that just disappears. The city is
right,
still there.
But in these cases, they lose their borrowing capacity, right? So they in the case of the bankruptcy itself is to protect them from their creditors. It's the creditors that really are driving that process, and they're the ones that demand that services be cut suddenly when those kinds of situations happen. And, you know, Orange County suffered from a bad treasurer. They had someone who was making risky bets. It's not like they completely got scammed. Like, they made some bad bets, and there was not appropriate reporting in place for that municipality. But the consequences of the bankruptcy was felt by regular people because their schools and services had to be slashed. People had to get fired. If you have, you know, this is why you need to sort of realign how investments are made in government. These treasurers are now so handicapped because of the rules trying to prevent what happened there that they can't extend the leverage of cities. We have entirely prevented them from doing this. And it's for good reason, because they were acting inappropriately, or this particular treasurer was acting inappropriately, and trusting or, you know, over investing through Wall Street. But if you have a public entity that can act like a bank and not like a treasurer and not like a development fund, but like a bank, but a bank owned by the people, then it will work to make those kinds of investments in a way that is self-sustainable, that's not speculative and is tied to a social good. And it can bring the alignment between the big picture, like you say, and the day-to-day, you know, debits and credits. That's the idea, right? In that, like, if you're talking about those trees, like, you keep cutting them, all those trees will always be, all those branches will be small. If you let them go, they get big and strong.
Mm-hmm. Well, a big objection to public banks or public anything is that it encroaches on the private area. But why should the private businesses have the advantage? I mean, for example, I'm just writing on China and the fact that they support their industries and they support their people with education and healthcare and that sort of thing. So they make it so that the workers actually can own their own homes. We think their workers are so poor, but they really aren't. But why shouldn't the government, you know, have the advantage? Why shouldn't they be able to, like, buy drugs at a cheaper price because they have the power of negotiation? Why shouldn't they be able to make loans much more cheaply, because the government is us? Why shouldn't we have the benefit of our own resources? Anyway, we just need to rethink the model, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, right now our system is designed to rely on and benefit from the investment of privately owned capital into areas where that capital can grow in a way that doesn't really threaten the base amounts, right, invested, and hopefully extract the maximum value out of every person in a given enterprise. That's how it's set up. There's not like, and it leads to growth. I mean, absolutely. It's undeniable that, you know, letting these pools of capital move freely in the liberated markets have unlocked value, but they've also extracted trillions of tons of CO2 and, like, completely benefited a very tiny portion of the Earth's population. Even as it has lifted millions and billions out of poverty, that's not the sum total of what has been achieved. I mean, the prosperity of Chinese workers is a very good thing, and their government sees that as an independent good and doesn't seem to care much that it distorts labor markets elsewhere or has monetary consequences, right, for the West. And they haven't really hit a wall. They're going to continue to grow, I imagine. There's plenty of problems I have with the Chinese government in terms of some of the other freedoms that their people may or may not enjoy. But from an economic perspective, they, you know, since the 80s, I guess, and really the 90s, have recognized that if they can create stability for certain kinds of investment, that they can get that capital in the door. But the real secret is harmony and productivity and widespread growth.
Well, this is all very interesting, and I'm so glad you're making such great progress. And I love the fact California Public Banking Alliance and Public Bank LA and the whole millennial generation is just making waves out there that people can see, and we can see that things have to change. So I congratulate you on your wins, or our wins. Do you want to tell people where they can learn more about the California Public Banking Alliance or Public Bank LA or your work?
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And these are a handful of victories. There's a lot of stuff still to do. And even if this bill passes, all it does is open the door. We're still going to need to create public banks locally. And, you know, our goal at California Public Banking Alliance is to make that happen and support movements and civic and community groups that want to help make that happen. Mm-hmm. We have representatives from 12 different cities and counties and regions across California, but we're always looking to add more. If folks want to join a public bank group in their locality, you can reach out to us at californiapublicbankingalliance.org, and we can put you in touch with one of our constituent organizations, or if there isn't one in your town, we can do our best to help you set that up. You know, once and if this bill passes, that'll be our shifted goal, is to really help groups explore how to apply for these public banks, how to get their city to move in that direction. And we're going to want to help those first few efforts with policy support and business and banking expertise as much as we can collect and donate to these member groups and their individual efforts. We hope that after this bill passes, within the next year or two, you're looking at probably a 5-year period of pilot banks, hopefully in Oakland, San Francisco, LA, and elsewhere. So
yeah, that would be
stay super connected. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's great talking to you, and great work to your whole team.
Thanks. Thanks for all your help.
Oh, yeah. Pretty exciting. More rewarding than money. All right. Great talking to you.
Ellen has been speaking with David Jetty, the legislative director for Public Bank LA and a spokesperson for the California Public Banking Alliance. More information about their work can be found at californiapublicbankingalliance.org. Perhaps it's something in the water in California that enables them to think outside the box so they don't get boxed in by their own entrenched patterns and perimeters. That's sort of the way our next guest might actually describe it. Swami Beyondananda now takes us on a word salad seance about money, banking, and our own mental state, which actually affects our actual state of affairs.
Hello, this is Swami Beyondananda. People often ask me, Swami, do you have any problems with money? I am happy to say I no longer have a problem with money. Without money, though, I still have problems. Spiritual teachers have long dreamed of a moneyless society, and now look at how many of us have a head start. Now, people have blamed the banking industry for our economic, new word, situation, and that is understandable. I don't know about you, but I am nostalgic for the good old days. Remember when people robbed banks? I mean, look at what the banks called themselves. Chase, Wachovia, Goldman Sachs. They're spelling it out for us. We are being sacked by the Goldmen. The banking industry has learned to use its energy, what the Chinese call qi, to gain unfair advantage. This is called cheating. Well, it's easy to blame banking and a rubber stamp Congress, and yet, finger pointing is pointless. And here is my point. You have one finger pointing out there, there's still three fingers pointing back at you. Because we are all responsible for buying into a system that insists that there is not enough and we have to feel afraid. This is called scarcity. When the true nature of nature and human nature is abundance. That is where we get up off of our assets, move our buns, and dance together in rhythm and flow to turn the funk into function and leave the junk at the junction. Well, there's good news, and that there's two promising projects that will help we distribute, that's we, W-E, financial well-being. The first is the public banking movement that actually puts money in the service of people rather than people in the service of money. Imagine. The golden rule overrules the rule of gold. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Swami, you're proposing a sane world. You must be crazy. Well, if you really want to commit yourself to a sane asylum, there's another project as well. It's called the Financial Freedom Act. Go Google that. Financial Freedom Act. And would replace the current tax system with a transaction tax on the $5 quadrillion that changes hands each year. Not only would this replace the current income tax and most other taxes, it would give us enough to pay off the national debt, provide health care for all, and give all adult Americans a guaranteed income of at least $24,000. Everyone benefits, from the super rich to the super poor. And both capitalism and socialism will be able to thrive together as we evolve from survival of the fittest to thrival of the fittingest. This is all part of the great evolutionary upwising, where we wake up to how we've been kept divided and wise up to how we can work together to redistribute financial well-being. This is Swami Byandananda. Namaste and namaste. Goodbye.
G-U-R-U. 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 G-U-R-U.
You can find more of Swami Byandananda's work and wisdom at wakeuplaughing.com. The Swami's given name is Steve Behrman, and you can hear him discuss his engaging new effort to launch a movement called Functional Politics, A Sane Idea for an Insane World, which we hosted on a previous edition of this program, airing in late February. You can find our podcast archives with that program at itsourmoney.podbean.com and listen to the show entitled 100 Years and Counting. Our thanks to the Swami for his insightful amusement. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.